Hey everyone, and welcome to At the Letters. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you. Arden Zwelling sitting just a few feet away. This week's episode produced by Gaetan Harris and Nick Andrade. So thanks to both of them. Arden, how's it going? We're here at spring.
Yeah, good. Thanks to the Blue Jays, I guess, or the TD Ballpark staff who may not know that we're even doing this in the home visitors radio booth. I don't know if it's home, if it's visitors, but we're in a booth here after a Blue Jays and Pirates tied Grapefruit League game.
Lots to get to in the course of this podcast. James Click is a member of the Toronto Blue Jays front office. The Jays are playing games. We've got prospects who are impressing. We've got some big leaguers who are making their spring debuts. Really, I mean, it's kind of wild when you're down here just how much information you get compared to the offseason where there's really not that same flow of information. So we've got a ton to get to. But Arden, you were just on the broadcast. Let's get to that first because it's kind of fun here in Florida. The Jays, of course, playing their games. I'm sitting in the shade working on some stories. You're down there in the camera bay absolutely roasting in the sun for about an hour and a half. But what was your impression? You were on there with Buck and Bent Wagner, of course. How did that go?
Yeah, I'm happy to be out of the sun at this time. I forget what the actual temperature was, but it was spicy here on, what is it, Thursday, March the 2nd here in Dunedin. So I'm happy to be in this radio booth. Like, I'll show people right now. Like, look, this is the radio booth you're watching on video. There's Ben literally right there. But yeah, that was my first broadcast, man. Now as part of the TV broadcast team. Today I was on with, as you said, Ben Wagner and Buck Martinez, and looking forward to getting to work with Joe Siddle and Dan Schulman, obviously. And, you know, I'm working with Hazel May regularly and, you know, Jamie Campbell. And those are just like the folks in front of the scene that are in front of the camera that you see every night. Like, there are so many talented and passionate people behind the scenes that I could go on, but, like, you know, Doug Walton and Andrew Stokely, you know, Troy Clara, like some of these people who have been helping me learn how to do something very new and very outside my comfort zone has been awesome. And they've been so welcoming. And, like, we know this from doing it sort of in the analyst role on the TV broadcast over several years, but, like, these people work so extremely hard and they're so passionate and they produce such an exceptional broadcast, and I am now joining it and just trying to live up to the level of it. I just don't want the standard to drop whenever I am on air. So it's a lot of pressure and it's challenging because it's new for me, but it's, like, a lot of fun. And it was cool just to get that first rep today, because this is something that I've obviously been thinking about and preparing for weeks and weeks and weeks. So it's cool to finally be doing it.
Yeah, the announcement came out a few weeks ago, but, you know, I imagine it's one of those things that, you know, in the abstract, okay, it's kind of a cool possibility. And then physically, even, like, you're in a different space. Like, for people who weren't watching today's broadcast, Arden is right beside the Blue Jays dugout in the camera area there, just near first base in this case. Like, you're physically very, very close to the game.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s bag was right beside my feet.
I hope you pushed it out of the way. So, I told him who was the more important person in that situation.
I helped myself to some batting gloves. Remember that ball that he laced to, like, left center?
Guerrero with a drive to left to the wall. Run down by Young.
And he came back and he kind of looked at me and, like, gave me a look and, like, shook his head. And I was like, "I just missed it." And he was like, "Yeah, just inside of it." Right. So it was kind of like, you know, you don't get to have those kind of interactions all the time. Probably not going to happen in regular season. It's spring training, right? So everybody's relaxed and loose, and guys are probably joking around with me a lot more down there than they normally would. But yeah, it's like you're in the dugout with, and I'm in that camera well with, like, you know, Ali Khan, who does the social stuff for the Blue Jays, John Woo, who collects a lot of their, you know, the content that you see for them on YouTube and on Twitter, Instagram. Like, we're all crammed in down there. Those guys are doing their jobs. There's a lot of activity, but it's a super cool vantage point to watch the game from.
Well, exactly. And as we go behind the scenes on ATL in the course of the season, I mean, you'll have that vantage point a lot. And so hopefully we can hear those insights, because, you know, I always find, and, like, here, as you said, we're sitting in the home radio booth. Both of us have called spring games from this spot before with Ben Wagner and years past with Mike Wilner. And it's a really cool vantage point. It's a really cool way to kind of view the game. And I think each role that I've ever done, you kind of get a new perspective. So I'm assuming that that'll probably be the case as things unfold, and hopefully you can share those insights on the pod.
Yeah, totally. I probably can't share too much, but I'm, you know, when I'm down there, I'm not thinking podcast. Like, I'm thinking about executing on the broadcast, right? And I'm thinking about doing the best job that I can in the not Hazel May role. Time I come on screen, everyone is saying, "Where's Hazel May? You're not Hazel May." So I'm, you know, I'm kind of focused on that. But yeah, I mean, even just in the course of doing that job, I'm having like a ton of conversations every day because I'm just trying to gather as much as possible and like talk to as many players as possible and as many, you know, coaches and any front office people that are kicking around and trying to just kind of glean as much information into the team. So yeah, it can only, you know, help me bring more to the podcast throughout the year.
Well, that's good. Still making time for the pod now that you're on the TV broadcast. This is good. This is good. You haven't ditched us for the greener pastures.
That's right. You present that like it was a choice.
We'll continue that thread as the season unfolds. But yeah, there really is a lot of action to get to on the field and even off the field. I'll start with a broad question here. Who have you seen in spring that's kind of jumped out to you in the course of the time that you've been here so far?
I mean, it's impossible not to be impressed by what Ricky Tiedemann did the other day. Obviously, Addison Barger, you know, impressive. Like, and these are guys that we don't get to see a ton throughout the course of the season. You can pull up sort of the minor league games or you can watch the highlights, but actually seeing it up close, you do get more of a sense for just the talent level there. As far as big leaguers, I mean, I watched Jose Berríos in Clearwater and I thought his sinker looked great. And that was huge. I mean, he had that thing on the edges where last year, far too often, we talked about this last week, it was over the heart of the plate. So I thought his sinker like looked really, really good. Hagen Danner has looked awesome. That's a guy who, if he doesn't get hurt last April, I think would have pitched in the big leagues last year. Absolutely electric stuff, like upper 90s power slider. You saw it at the Arizona Fall League, the way he was blowing away hitters and just some of the velocity that he was showing. And then, you know, shout out Spencer Horwitz, who's had some nice, some interesting plate appearances, like showing a very professional approach. And Otto Lopez today, a guy who, you know, hit a line drive late in that game. And that's so huge for him because he makes such great contact, but so much of it has been on the ground over the course of his career. And he's making some swing changes with Guillermo Martinez in the cages and working on some different things.
Lines it up the middle, a base hit into center.
Like, I know how important that was for him and how pleased the Blue Jays would have been to see him come up with that line drive here late on Thursday, because that's exactly what he's trying to do. Because if he can maintain that contact but get the ball just kind of a bit more line drive exit angle off of his bat, he could really change the power numbers and tap into that speed to race into second, have some more extra base hits to go with, like, an already, like, the guy's hitting 300 in the minor leagues. So that's a big step for him.
Well, Otto Lopez has a chance to make this team out of spring. He'll play for Canada at the WBC, some infield. He played center field the other day for the Jays, so he's definitely a name to watch as the Jays try to fill out this roster. You mentioned some of the prospects, and I really want to get to Ricky Tiedemann, but Addison Barger, I mean, this is a guy, he fills out a uniform. He can definitely hit for a lot of power, and he can play some infield for you. You know, he's already impressed going deep in spring already. And at this point, like, you know, he's obviously not a candidate to break camp with the team, but, you know, he's putting himself on that radar as far as mid-season, something happens, you need a player, you need a bat. Like, he actually could, and he's, I want to say 23, 24 years old too. So he's a kid, but he's not, you know, it's not like he's, you know, Tiedemann's only 20. So there's a bit of a difference there. So what are you seeing from Barger as far as what he's doing so far this spring?
It's just electric bat speed. I mean, we don't have the bat speed data for big leaguers. Certainly don't have it for minor leaguers, but I would love to see how he measures up against some of the higher bat speed guys in the majors. Already, like, the exit velocities that you see from him, this guy would easily be a top 100 exit velo guy in MLB.
Like, wow.
He, like, absolutely barrels the ball. And the hand speed, the bat speed has really stood out to me. Like, I saw him against David Bednar the other day in Bradenton. I want to say we were, all these Florida towns kind of blend together sometimes. I'm pretty sure that was in Bradenton. And like, Bednar, like, Pirates closer, 96 away from Addison Barger. And like, his bat is so fast. He turns on this ball and pulls it and somehow keeps it fair and hits it a million feet out over the wall. And this is a guy in Barger who is like standing all over the plate, big leg kick, tries to hit every ball 700 feet. It's just really impressive, some of those, like some of those actions at the plate. And we haven't even actually seen his arm at third yet, or at least I haven't. Maybe you've seen it, but like I haven't seen him get to show it off. He might have the biggest arm at third base in this organization. So I'm looking forward to see that as well.
I mean, that's a bold statement considering who's playing third base at the major league level and Matt Chapman.
Yeah. I'm not just saying that.
No, I know. But, I know. Do you know offhand what his exit velo numbers are?
At Arizona, his max exit velo was 109. He had a 44.4% hard hit rate in the AFL. And then in the Blue Jays system, he's actually been up to 112.
Wow.
So okay. Like, we're talking like, yeah, legit stuff.
Yeah. I mean, so for reference, I mean, the very, very best in the game get maybe 118 to 120. That's Ohtani. That's Giancarlo Stanton. Vlad Jr.'s in that every year. You know, a very good major league player might max out at like 106, 107.
112 would be like Andrew Vaughn or Javi Baez.
Yeah.
In that range.
That's really good. That's actually a perfect chance to move on to Ricky Tiedemann, because Javi Baez was the first big league hitter that Ricky Tiedemann faced right here in Dunedin a couple days ago. And Tiedemann didn't even realize who he was facing when he saw, you know, the Tigers hitter coming up to the plate.
Do you believe him when he says that?
I don't know. I'm not in the business of trying to read minds here.
How could you not know?
Yeah, I think I was watching him really closely. So sitting not far from where we are right now, and it's a pretty good view from the press box, and I bring my binoculars to spring training. And so I was just kind of training them on Ricky Tiedemann to watch him.
Ben's that guy in the press box with his binoculars.
Well, I mean, I want to see them. You know, I want to know what's happening. I'm here for a reason. I'm not just going to, you know, sit in the stands and you know, put my feet up. I want to know what's going on. So, you know, I have my binoculars on Ricky Tiedemann, and I'm just trying to get a sense for how he's preparing and really facing these hitters. And I was struck by it. I kind of almost do believe, I say almost because I'm not totally sold, but I almost do believe that he didn't know who was hitting, because he was locked in. He was really composed. His eyes were just down, looking at the plate, preparing, throwing, getting the ball back, and really throwing with some great results. 98 to 99 miles an hour against Baez. He struck him out, then got a ground ball off the bat of Austin Meadows, and then got another strikeout against Matt Vierling on a changeup. So, you know, that's three major league hitters, and of course, like, it's one inning. We don't want to read too much into it. Like, Tiedemann could go out and post a 6 ERA at AA this year. Like, these things are still on the table. We don't know what's going to happen. I'm not trying to go over the top with the hype here, but as far as debuts go, it literally was best case scenario, and he did exactly what the Blue Jays would want to see from him.
Yeah, take nothing away from the stuff that he demonstrated in that outing, right? Because, like, obviously the velo from the left side, and look, he's not going to be carrying 99 through a start, right? So people say, oh, there's a starter, he's throwing 99. Yeah, that's not what's gonna happen at a start. He's throwing one inning, right? But still, big time velo from the left side. The slider is great. I love his changeup, and I love how his changeup works off the rest of his repertoire, right? Works off of the fastball up and the slider moving one way, and then that changeup just falls off. It's great stuff. But I know you'll remember this, early in 2020 camp, right before the pandemic shut everything down, when we were all unknowingly breathing COVID all over one another. Remember when Nate Pearson went to face the Pittsburgh Pirates? I remember when he was blowing 99 past big league hitters. Remember that Josh Bell strikeout where Bell like dropped the bat? The pitch just like got up in his kitchen and maybe swung to the called strike, but was like 99 from Pearson. And it was the same conversation. This guy's got to start on the big league club. This guy is the future. This guy's going to be an amazing starter. Well, here we are 3 years later, and you're still trying to figure it out with Nate Pearson. So definitely some trepidation is warranted when it comes to Ricky Tiedemann here. But like, take nothing away from the stuff that he's demonstrating, because that does not grow on trees.
Exactly. I mean, most pitchers run into some sort of interruptions by the time they establish themselves in the major leagues. And sometimes that takes years. Obviously, that's what we're seeing from Pearson, who was pretty good today, just as a quick aside there. We'll see what he can do as he continues to try to, you know, push closer toward the Blue Jays roster. But, you know, in the case of Tiedemann, it's really interesting because Pearson was 23 when he debuted. Alek Manoah was 23 when he debuted. Ricky Tiedemann is 20 years old. this is a big guy. Like, he's, you know, bigger than I thought. He's 6'4", like well over 200 pounds, you know, big, big dude. And there's a lot of development there potentially, but he's on an accelerated path. Like, you start looking at, you know, just his age and where he's at, he's going to start the year, you know, chances are, nothing's written in stone, chances are he's going to start at AA and go from there. This is a guy who has a chance to impact in the major leagues this year when he's 20, 21 years old. I mean, this is a accelerated time frame, and he's really showing the Jays some impressive stuff.
Oh, he's going to start the year in AA then. I asked somebody the other day, I said, Ricky Tiedemann's starting the year AA, right? And the person looked at me and said, Arden, he has 11 AA innings. Yeah. He's starting the year at AA. Well,
all I mean by that is, you know, like, could he start in high A for a couple games?
Oh, or, you know, what I mean? Even further down.
Or could he be a AAA? Like, the point being, he's not going to be in the major leagues.
He's not going to start in the major leagues. He's not going to start at AAA. He's going to start at AA. And that's where he should start, honestly, has 11 AA innings. The guy hasn't surpassed 5 innings in a start in his professional career, hasn't surpassed 85 pitches in a start in his professional career, right? Like, right, the innings load overall in 22 was somewhere around 85.
78 innings.
78, yep. Right? The Blue Jays are going to be very deliberate about how they build him up, because they don't just want Ricky Tiedemann to be this high octane reliever out of the bullpen. Like, they want him to be Alek Manoah. They don't want him to be a flash in the pan. They don't want to be 3 years down in the situation they are with Nate Pearson now with Ricky Tiedemann. They want to build him up to be like at the top of their rotation. They want him making playoff starts in 2025 and 2026.
Maybe 2024.
Maybe. So I look, here's the thing. I think that his workload progression this year will be deliberate with that in mind, with how he could impact the club in September and possibly in October. So maybe he even starts with shorter outings in 2023 just to hold him back a little bit. Maybe they go back to the model that they used with him last year, where mid-season they pulled him out of competition and they used that development list to bring him to Dunedin, get him in the pitching lab to check things out. Like, I've talked to people who were there and they're like, yeah, all of his stuff, like all of his metrics is all the same, like the strength, the arm, you know, the release point, all that stuff was all the same as in spring training. Like, this kid works hard. His routines are solid. I mean, he maintained at that point. We were so impressed. But maybe they use that model again, just depending on how a workload is going, because I do think they will be mindful of the fact that, yes, this is somebody who could be very impactful for us at the big league level in September or October this year. But then that is going to influence how he pitches, how long he pitches, how often he pitches, where he pitches in April, May, June, July.
And that's why these outings are significant, because when he gets the chance to step in there against the Tigers, whose, you know, big league lineup is still on the field at that point in the game, it's a great chance for him to test himself and for the Jays to assess how is he responding in these situations, how is he throwing his secondary pitches, what's his command like, what's his composure like. I mean, what am I missing there as far as, you know, I guess it's preparation. There are a lot of these things beyond that box score that the Jays look for when they're trying to assess how a prospect progresses through the minors.
Recovery in between outings, arm care, sleep, nutrition, how you live your life, all that stuff goes into it. It's all the stuff that like Alek Manoah dominates at. Like, we were talking about on a recent podcast, he is the here at 5:30 in the morning guy. Like, he's the guy. Have you ever seen Alek Manoah around the facility just like kind of goofing around, right? Like, the guy is always, he's carrying weighted balls, or he's, you know, doing his routine with his football, he's coming from the weight room, he's drenched in sweat, he's doing this, he's doing that, right? Like, he's, it's all of that work that you don't see in the 3 hours that a game is on every night. So that's going to be the stuff that really separates Ricky Tiedemann and convinces the Blue Jays to move him up. He might go out to AA and through the first, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 outings, just show that the level isn't challenging him anymore. And at that point, the Blue Jays will say, you're not learning anything at AA anymore. You're not getting better from facing these hitters. Now we'll advance you to AAA. I mean, very best case scenario, fastest scenario, like June, probably mid-season, somewhere around there. Maybe after he comes, you know, if he comes back to the pitching lab again, we'll see. By the way, that developmental model, as an aside, of pulling guys out and bringing them into Dunedin mid-season using the development list is something you're going to see the Blue Jays do more of this year. I think you're going to see them do that with more pitchers as they try to just develop guys a little differently and manage workloads and have those midseason check-ins. I think they learned a lot from the model with Tiedemann. But yeah, he could be up the AAA by midseason. It's going to depend, like you said, on all of that off-field stuff that goes beyond the box score.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I'd be really fascinated to see him in the majors at some point this year. So we'll see where that goes. But let's touch also on Manoa. You know, he's probably the rarity in this, where he's that pitching prospect who comes up through the minors, does amazing, gets to the majors, does amazing. Like, there hasn't really been an interruption for him. And it was occurring to me, you know, he was talking when you were on the broadcast today, down the right field line, I was talking to Manoa with a few of the other media members. And I kind of asked him, like, hey, this is your first chance really to have a normal spring. Because 2021, he basically had to prove himself. He wasn't a major leaguer. 2022, it was this weird accelerated spring where there was so much pressure to really get your work done in a hurry. And I think that impacted the whole camp in a lot of different ways, but in particular for Manoa, whereas now he's an established starter, a Cy Young finalist, and he's finally able to go through the camp at his own pace, at his own progression.
Yeah, and credit to him, he's working on some very small things at this camp, but like, they could be really meaningful to him. He wants to hit less batters going forward. He's led at least the American League, if not MLB, in hit batters each of the last 2 years. And to him, it's like, I don't need to give away those extra base runners. We're not talking about a ton of base runners here. We're talking 15 or 16, but he's like, yeah, if that's eight, that's just fewer base runners, fewer chances of damage against me, of me running into the home run ball at the worst possible time. He wants to improve his changeup. And like, I literally just got off of a broadcast and did not have Savant open, but just watching his changeup today looks different. And I would like to look at some of the metrics from it today and actually talk to him about some of the changes he's made with it today, because he has been holding those cards sort of close to the vest at this point in spring when you ask him about the changeup, because I don't think he really wants to tip anybody off yet. But now he's actually throwing it in games, so there's no denying what the break is on it and what the velo is on it. So I did like how his changeup looked today, and I know that's a big focus for him, and he just wants to like generally work ahead more often, and he just wants to do some of those little things that are going to help him over the course of a season. If like, say, some bad ball luck turns against him this year, right? Like, say some of those balls in play, it's drop in, clang off a wall, whatever, you get bad calls from the ump, like just say some of that baseball stuff happens that increases his ERA this year, he can help pull some of that back by taking care of some of those little things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like he's eager to do that, on a good pace to be able to get built up fully for opening day. Before we take a bit of a break here on At the Letters, let's also touch on Yusei Kikuchi. We were there in Sarasota, Florida yesterday watching Kikuchi against the Orioles. And again, I mean, I know, you know, we were almost kidding about it on a recent episode about the Yusei Kikuchi hype. Now here I am contributing to it because he did look good. And, you know, it's a totally different challenge to do it in Sarasota than it is to do it at Yankee Stadium. But I mean, he was good. You can't take that away from him.
And forgive me for not remembering the particulars, but he walked the first batter of his second inning.
Yep.
And I forget who he was facing.
It was Arias.
Was it? Yeah. And he was kind of battling with the pitch clock at that point. Like, he was wanting to get right down to the one and was missing all over the place. And I know for a fact that John Schneider and Pete Walker turned to each other in the dugout and said, let's see what happens now. Because they saw that story with him before last year, where you walk the first batter of an inning on four pitches, and now you go 3-0 to the next guy and you leave a cookie over the plate, and now there's runners in second and third, and then you walk the next guy on a full count pitch, and now your pitch count in the inning's up to 18, and you're sweating and you're doing a lot of body movement on the mound and things are getting long on you, and then boom, right, off goes like extra bases. So credit to Yusei Kikuchi, came right back firing strikes, like composed himself, came right back in the zone, and three quick outs. So that's what you want to see, is that type of stuff. Like, I think that was big for him. I'm still just personally going to need to see him do it in a major league game, because it is different doing it in front of like 6,000, sextagenarians in Florida here versus at Fenway Park in front of however many thousand rowdy Fenway patrons. But it's encouraging so far what he is doing. I like that new slurve thing that he's throwing. It seems to be getting swing and miss, seems to be keeping hitters off balance. We'll see. Like, his pitch mix really evolved over the course of last season, so we'll see how it continues to evolve this season. But what I kept hearing all last year was, like, if he just throws his breaking ball hard and down, it's effective. When he gets kind of loopy with the breaking ball, kind of long with it, when he gets slow with the breaking ball, damage. When he throws cutters up, damage. But if he throws that, like, high 80s breaking ball down in the zone, it's a real weapon. So it looks like he's starting to find that.
Just stay in the zone. Same for Tiedemann too. He's got great stuff. Just stay in the zone. So that'll be something to watch here for those two guys. All right, we'll come back in a moment here on At the Letters. And when we do, we'll talk more about Alejandro Kirk and James Click. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to At the Letters. Ben Nicholson-Smith, still here with Arden Swelling. The stadium is now quiet. The leaf blowers are done. That's good. That can be a curse, really, to the to any sort of broadcasting efforts that we try to do. So we've dodged, I'm going to jinx it now, but I think we've dodged the leaf blowers yeah. for today.
Security guy's going to barge in. And yeah, it's exactly. Like, yeah, still here. You caused me to look at the clock. We have now passed 5 p.m. Yes. Eastern. I rolled into the PDC at like 7:15 this morning. Yeah. So it's been a very, honestly, typical spring training day.
It's right. It is a typical spring day. We got a great view here. I wish we could share it with our audience. Most of whom are listening, but some of whom can see us inside the booth. But we got a great view of the field that is now quiet. But a couple days ago here, Chris Bassett was on the mound making his spring debut and working with Danny Jansen. That's going to be a process. It's going to take a bit of time to get to know, you know, a new team, and maybe for Bassett more so than for some other new pitchers.
Yeah, that's going to take some time. You could even see in that outing a lot of shaking, a lot of communication between Bassett and Jansen. Like, Bassett is like renowned for being a guy who's very particular about how he likes his catchers to set up, the lanes that they're in. He's very particular about the pitches that are called. I mean, he's a classic guy. He should be using the reverse pitch calm. Interesting, Jose Berríos was using it the other day in Clearwater with Rob Brantley, and like, Brantley hadn't caught him before. So if Brantley flashed, the process they used was, if Brantley flashed two signs and Berríos didn't like either of them, Berríos would punch it in. It was kind of on his hip.
Nice.
So just to avoid clock violations, essentially. But he still was like, look, I want to follow the catcher's game plan, and catchers have a good idea of what's going on with swings at the plate and where hitters are setting up. But that was kind of the process they used. I also talked to another pitcher the other day who said, by midseason, every starter is going to want to use this. Like, this is going to be really common if you're allowed to use it in regular season. It hasn't actually been approved for regular season use yet, although I imagine it will be. The like PitchCom from catcher to pitcher started this way, where they said, we'll just test it in spring and then see if we approve it for regular season. But that's interesting. But anyway, yeah, like, Bassett is classic, you know, very, very meticulous and very, very stringent about how he likes his catchers to set up, to receive, to set targets, when to set up. So that's going to be a process with Danny Jansen for sure.
And just to go back quickly to the reverse PitchCom. So to clarify, this is the pitcher calling it off of his body rather than the catcher, which actually, when you think about it, kind of makes more sense to begin with.
Depends.
Depending on the pitcher, right? And depending on how you want to go about things. But
I talked to a pitcher the other day about it who said, I don't want to use it because I'm not that smart.
Yeah.
I just leave that stuff to the catcher and I throw what they put down. I don't want to have to think about game plans. I just want to think about executing.
But for some pitchers, and Hyunjin Ryu would be in this category, like, he has an idea of what he wants to do, and it's not an idea that's easily disrupted.
No. And guys like Chris Bassett, who have like nothing shorter than 7 or 8 pitches on their Savant page, they actually just added another one for Chris Bassett because Savant just broke out sweepers from sliders. So now Bassett has a cutter, a slider, and a sweeper, which all move the same way, but it's like three sort of variations of the same pitch at different velocities and different movements, ball moving the same direction. I actually confirmed with Chris that he supports breaking out the sweeper. He thinks they have classified that correctly. But he also told me some things on there not classified correctly, but he doesn't want the other side to know exactly what pitches those are.
A little mystique on his side, which actually is probably good. I mean, Baseball Savant gives so much information away, and I can see as a pitcher, you might not want that so clearly labeled for your opponents.
As much as there are any secrets in this game, there still seem to be some secrets with Chris Bassitt. It was interesting too, seeing his velocity out of the chute in his first outing, and he was like, yeah, I'm not throwing as hard as I'm going to in the regular season. It's February. I'm trying to pitch in October.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to like light up the radar gun here and be on the IL by May. I'm in this for the long run. I've learned like this is how I haul innings, is by building up very deliberately at this time in spring.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of funny when he said that, and you kind of think about it. It's like, yeah, people at home, like they're lacing up boots. You know, they got their winter tires on. Like this is not the time of year that you want to be going 100%. And it is different if you're a prospect like Tiedemann. This is your chance to impress. You got to take advantage of it. Or if you're Kikuchi, you know, you probably don't want to ease in too slowly to things. You want to show everyone involved, including himself, that he's ready to go. But Bassitt, it's his eighth year in the major leagues. He doesn't have to necessarily show on day one his max velocity. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it's a little different when you just signed like a 3-year free agent contract for $20 million a year versus when you're 20 years old at your first big league spring training. You're not even on the 40-man roster yet. You're not even in the union yet. But I do... It does make me think, right? Because they're all still pitchers. So certain pitchers that we're seeing coming out now, particularly starters, I get the relievers a little different, but particularly starters who are throwing 99 now, who are throwing like upper 90s today, what's that going to mean for them in August? What's that going to mean for them in June? Minor league guys who, you know, maybe have a shorter season, major league guys who like maybe want to try to still be pitching in October, throwing that hard now. What's that going to mean about me, you know, for maintaining that over 6, 7, 8 months?
Yeah, the pressure's very different for those younger players compared to some of the older ones. And it's kind of funny how it can actually change really quickly. And I was talking to Kevin Biggio about this the other day because, you know, he's a guy, he's entering his fifth major league season, which, you know, as he put it, is kind of crazy. He's about to turn 28 years old. He's not a kid in this game anymore. And neither are Vlad Jr. and Bo Bichette. You know, you look at the way they interact with other players around the league, you look at their stature in the league. These guys are young, they're young men, but they're young veterans in this league already, in contrast to someone like a Barger or a Tiedemann. It's just, it's kind of remarkable. Biggio was saying, you know, he can remember pretty vividly, as I'm sure most, if not all of our ATL listeners can, Justin Smoke, Troy Tulowitzki, Josh Donaldson. I mean, we've covered these guys, Arden. Like, we know it goes by really quick. The life cycle of a major league player is so fast and it happens so quickly. You know, it's kind of wild when you think about that in the span of like 4 or 5 years.
It's on the broadcast today in the dugout with Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah.
Edwin has had 1 3 homer game. High and deep to right.
Right beside me in the dugout, I was like, hey, Eddie,
yep.
I covered you, right? And now here he is as the coach around like the batting cages. He's going to be going over to the minor league side and like helping some minor leaguers who like amazing. What a guy to learn about hitting from, right? And yeah, he's around this camp. Like we, you know, Paul Quantrill's been around. Victor Martinez.
Yeah.
Victor Martinez, it wasn't that long ago that he was in the league and really good. So it does go fast. You mentioned Biggio. How about Kevin Biggio like calling John Schneider this offseason and asking him like, hey, or don't be afraid to play me in the outfield. I want more reps.
Well, exactly. I mean, this was a really interesting conversation and it's kind of unique. I mean, Biggio and Schneider go back a long way. They've known each other since Biggio was drafted in 2016. And so there's more of an open communication there than there would be between your standard utility player to first-year manager relationship. And Biggio straight up said to Schneider, like, I am kind of frustrated by how little you played me last year. And I want to be in the outfield more. I think I'm more capable of playing that. It was all done professionally. I talked to them both about it in the last couple of days. And, you know, it was a very professional conversation. Neither one of them seems, you know, at all upset about it. But it was an honest, candid conversation. And then it ended with Schneider saying to Biggio, we're going to get you into the outfield more. We're going to get you into right field along with his second base and first base work. And so on days that Springer is DHing, on days that, you know, Springer's off for whatever reason, right field is empty, I think we're going to see a fair bit of Kevin Biggio there.
I think he's going to play more this year than he did last year. We'll like obviously see how that goes. I think he's probably going to face some lefties this year.
He wants to,
and I think he believes that he can hit left-handed pitching and just hasn't had the opportunity to. We'll see how that goes. Like that mix with him, Santiago Espinal, Whit Merrifield is going to play a ton. Like I do think that early last year, it very quickly fell in the favor of Santiago Espinal playing very regularly, and he was an all-star over the first half, so credit to him, but perhaps some flaws in his swing got exposed over the second half. And then the club goes out and gets Whit Merrifield, and then it was essentially like a rotation between Espinal, Merrifield, and Biggio down the stretch. It's just going to be interesting to see how that playing time breaks out. And then you've got an Addison Barger knocking on the door at Triple-A. I mean, you've got a Spencer Horwitz who could factor into the first base mix. We saw him playing right field today. He's on the 40 man, and he has like one of the most professional plate approaches in this organization, like does not give plate appearances away. And over the course of 500, 600 of those, I mean, that could be the difference of like 20, 30 points on your batting average. Like I think Spencer Horwitz is going to be a guy who's going to get some major league plate appearances this year. So yeah, there's a lot of players sort of in that mix. It's just going to be interesting to see how Kevin Biggio runs with some increased playing time early in the season.
Yeah, it really will. And there could be some DH at bats kind of factoring in, at least, you know, one level removed for guys like Springer or Vlad Jr. If either one of those guys is DHing, that opens things up for Biggio to get in there.
If Brandon Belt suffers an injury, Spencer Horwitz is probably the guy there, right?
Yeah, and real quick on Belt. So he hasn't played yet. The Jays say he's still on track to play, should be able to get a couple of weeks of games in. They're saying it's not a concern. To me, it's got to be a bit of a concern, but I don't know where you land.
My understanding coming into spring was that they were going to be deliberate with him coming off of the knee procedure, because he's not a center fielder. So he's not like the position he plays and his role in this team, which is primarily DH and a little bit of spelling Vladdy at first. It's not as demanding. You don't need as much time to build up for it. He's a guy who says he doesn't need that many plate appearances in spring to get ready for the season. I like saw him out there doing defensive drills today, working on relays. So like he was participating in on-field stuff today, just isn't in games yet. So yeah, I'm not going to raise the concern flag just yet. But like this is a guy who's dealt with injuries the last, you know, several seasons, and he believes that he's had what was going on in his knee corrected, and he says he feels as well as he has in years. So you believe him and you see how it goes. But there's certainly a world where it's like May 1st and it's an IL stint for knee inflammation. We'll see how this goes.
And maybe it's a question too of just, you only got so many bullets, you know, you've only got so many stops and starts, so many max effort swings. Maybe you just don't want to use those on March the 2nd. And if that's the case, that's understandable. But it is a time of year where you do kind of try to figure out, you know, whether there should be concern or not. And a week ago this time, we were wondering that with respect to Alejandro Kirk, his ramp up. Now we have some certainty. He is not playing for Team Mexico in the WBC. He has now a baby daughter as of a few days ago. Very exciting news for him and his family, of course. And that has allowed him to come back to Blue Jays camp and get ready. And it seems like he's going to have all the time that he needs to get ready for opening day.
Yeah, we talked to him this morning. He reported very early this morning. And like, congratulations to him and his partner, Sophia, on their daughter, Amelia, obviously. And yeah, some of the work for Kirk has already begun in California. Like the Blue Jays sent Luis Hurtado out there. He's their bullpen catcher. They sent Jose Mayorga out there. He's like a coach at the Complex League here in Dunedin. So they were able to get him catching off of high velocity pitching machines and throwing to bases and stuff like that. But he hasn't really faced live pitching yet or anything. So he's essentially coming into camp as a position player would come into camp. So he's going to get like a week and a half of buildup, of defensive work on backfields, of getting into live BPs. And so he's not going to get into games until late next week, realistically. Same thing for Belt. So we'll kind of see how this goes. It's definitely a condensed time frame, but he has the advantage at least of knowing the majority of pitchers on this staff, and it looks like he's not getting the Chris Bassitt assignment, which is like the most challenging assignment that there is to give there, which makes sense because he's such a good pairing with Manoah, obviously. Yep. I think he's a good pairing with Gausman, with the way that Gausman likes to work down in the zone and the way that, like,
the framing numbers,
right, Kirk can kind of vacuum things up there. So those are two guys that he already knows and that he pairs well with. So I don't think that anyone needs to be too worried about him being prepared for opening day.
Agreed. I think he'll be ready. I think those concerns are fast moving away for the Blue Jays and for Kirk. And, you know, he has had the chance to throw to bases. He has had the chance to field some short hops and you know, work with a pitching machine, a high-velocity machine. That's good. And the one thing that he can do and probably doesn't need, as much preparation as some guys, is hit. Because he's always been able to hit. And, you know, that hand-eye coordination isn't going to disappear overnight. Like, he's still going to have that short stroke, those bat-to-ball skills, the eye at the plate. Of course he needs reps. Of course he's not going to go in there completely cold. But he seems to be in a really good position.
Yeah, he rolls out of bed finding barrels.
Yeah,
and then he has the vision and discipline at the plate to carry him through periods where maybe his timing isn't quite there, because his pitch recognition is so good, his management of the strike zone is so good, so he can still find a way to be productive and, like, get on base even if he isn't hitting that. Haven't we've seen these periods from before where there aren't extra base hits, there isn't a bunch of power, but, like, there is still on base because he can still, this is still a guy who legitimately could walk more than he strikes out at the big league level, which is crazy,
incredibly hard to do. Yeah, incredibly rare. I think Eddie actually did it once.
Did he?
I think he did. He came close anyway. But it's tough to do. And I think, you know, it's really interesting, actually, when you think about the Jays catching depth chart, because, of course, Danny Jansen will be prominent on that list. And I had the chance to speak to Dalton Varsho this afternoon and kind of ask him, hey, have you even put on the catching gear? And the answer was no, he hasn't. He doesn't plan to. So Varsho is pretty much, I thought he might be 10 to 12 games catching for the Jays. And then I put it to him, I'm like, it sounds a bit more like it'll be the 0 to 4 range. And he's like, yeah, that's what it's looking like. So he's pretty much an emergency catcher on this team, which kind of means that Rob Brantley is the next guy up if they needed someone to step in for any period of time.
Rob Brantley will play major league games for the Toronto Blue Jays this year. Like, that is going to happen. He's a great guy. Like, he's very, reminds me of Caleb a little bit, our colleague. Yep. Caleb Joseph. He's fun to talk to. He's fun to watch catch. He is super flexible and athletic behind the plate. It's incredible. Like, just watching him catch, I swear, he receives some breaking balls. I was talking to him about this today, where, like, he has one knee on the ground and his legs stretch straight out, and it's like his ass is, like, on the ground as he receives it. And then he is still, like, braced in his core and able to pop up and throw the bases and manage running game. He's an impressive, like, athlete for his age, really. I like watching him receive. I can't wait to watch him with, like, a Joe Siddle or a Buck Martinez, some of the catchers, Caleb, some of the catchers that we have around, and kind of hear their take on it. It's always fun to hear catchers on catchers. Brantley, by the way, caught Nate Pearson in his first outing of spring, and Nate is, like, featuring this new curveball, which is really interesting. It's harder than his old curveball. If you remember, Pearson's curveball before, it was, like, you know, kind of like the Bassitt, well, no one's is like Bassitt, but it was like that mid-70s, like, kind of big rainbow looping thing. He's throwing, like, this hard curveball now, which is sort of like low 80s. Yeah, like, snapping it off. It gets on the hitter quickly. He thinks it's going to play better off of his fastball. He used it in the Winter League, kind of developed it late last year, and then, like, really deployed it in the Dominican, liked the results with it. He wants to up his curveball usage this year. He's a guy who, like, is still, his slider is going to be the primary, like, out pitch. That's going to be what he throws most often off his fastball. But I'm just interested to see how that curveball plays for him, because it looked like he was landing some nice ones in the zone, which is huge for him. First pitch can be huge for him as a, you know, surprise pitch in a fastball count. And then if he can kind of bury it below the zone as well and get swing and miss, I think it could be a weapon for him. So I'm interested to see how that goes.
Yeah, Nate Pearson, always an interesting guy to watch. At this point, probably slated to start in AAA. I think that's probably safe to say.
Looks like it. We'll see how things shake out towards that back end of the Blue Jays bullpen. We mentioned kind of the lack of optionable relievers and what that could mean. I haven't checked in with Mitch White in a while, and I should just see where he's at.
Not close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe he's beginning the year on the IL, yeah. And then that opens a spot. Like, you are going to want some length towards the back end of that bullpen. If you don't have Mitch White there, I mean, who does that open an opportunity for? Like, what kind of length is Nate Pearson giving you? Are you looking at him as just like a 3-4-5 out reliever? And then if you are you okay with carrying him and not having someone who could legitimately take like a full trip through or cover 3-4 innings if you needed?
Yeah, and I think Trevor Richards almost can be that guy for the Jays who absorbs multiple innings if they need it. John Schneider saying just earlier this afternoon that he kind of likes Nate Pearson as an early game reliever. And, you know, that doesn't mean low leverage, but it could be earlier in the game because, you know, let's face it too. Like, even if the Yusei Kikuchi hype is real, even if this is, you know, best case scenario, is he going to see the seventh inning very often? You know, it's not the game. It's not the way the game works.
If you get two trips through from Yusei Kikuchi and it's gone okay, you're like, yep, let's off to the bullpen we go.
And that's the norm in Major League. The Jays actually have a very good starting rotation, so they have guys who can pitch into the sixth and seventh. But that's not a knock on Kikuchi. It's just the way the game has shifted. And so if you have Pearson, even if he's going 3-4 outs, that could work for you.
Yeah, I wonder about Trent Thornton, if he could fit in there. Like, he's a guy who's seen that role before. We know the Blue Jays like him, like, spins the crap out of the ball. I'm sure he's working on some new pitches like he always is at this time of year. I mean, Yosfer Zulueta is on the 40-man now. The Blue Jays still committed to him as a starter and are still going to start, like, have him starting games early in the season, obviously very likely at AAA. Maybe some shorter starts just because there isn't a ton of workload there with the years that he missed with the, he had TJ and then he blew out his knee like three pitches into his return. So like, there just isn't like a base of workload those there. So they're going to have to be like very careful with sort of managing things this year and his innings. And he's a guy who it's kind of the Tiedemann thing as well, where they might start him slow because they're thinking, hey, in September, October, you might be really useful for us out of a bullpen in a postseason series, like as a weapon with high octane stuff. So I doubt Zulueta breaks with the club, but he would be another option for them as a guy who can provide some length. But I am very sure they will just prioritize his development and likely have him begin the year with some shorter outings just to manage his workload over the course of the year.
All right, so we also have to get to one of the bigger storylines around the Jays. So the GM who won the World Series a few months ago,
yeah, James like Clark, that.
Yeah, he is a longtime executive, came up with the Tampa Bay Rays, and then spent the last 3 years with the Houston Astros, a team that made the ALCS in three consecutive seasons, won the World Series last year. We can get into all sorts of questions there about, you know, how do you want to assign credit? It's probably futile, not necessarily the most productive way to, you know, try to assess these things. But safe to say, this is an accomplished executive. You don't win the World Series by accident, even if you're given a good roster. And because of some of the issues with ownership there in Houston, Jim Crane offering a one-year deal, there's some questions as far as how he fit in with ownership. Dusty Baker's contract was also up. A lot of questions there. We don't need to answer all of those now. And certainly we couldn't even if we tried because there are a lot of factors there. But safe to say, James Click became available and was very coveted as an executive. At that point, Toronto Blue Jays have some discussions with him, bring him to Florida, and end up signing him as a VP in their strategy world, in their front office. So I guess just to begin, what do you make of this?
Yeah, it's the defending World Series champion GM, right? Like, that's a big deal. Like, this is somebody who can head up a baseball operations group. This is somebody who would have touched all parts of like a model organization in baseball. When you look at the Houston Astros, and before that, the Tampa Bay Rays. So like two models of player development, of ingenuity, of creativity, finding every advantage possible, and honestly of winning in this game. So that's pretty incredible pedigree. As you said, James Click had options. There were other places that he could have gone. The Blue Jays brought him to Dunedin in January, and he spent like a day and a half here kind of meeting everybody and working with various department heads and kind of getting a sense of what the role would be. So they sold him on the role, obviously, effectively. It sounds like he won't have a primary focus out of the gate, whether that's development, scouting, whatever. Like, it sounds like he's going to kind of take time offering an objective viewpoint on processes across the organization, which is like really useful coming from a guy with a significant R&D background and coding background, who kind of look at the Blue Jays models and look at the way that they make decisions and look at the way that they evaluate players and say like, huh, have you thought about doing it this way? Like, huh, like, why do you do this? Like, just kind of test the way the Blue Jays are making decisions and the way that they are operating. Like, that's just going to be so helpful to the Blue Jays, I think. And I think that's why Ross Atkins went out and targeted James Click and brought him in the way that he did.
Yeah, I think, you know, bringing in a former GM to your organization is just such a low downside move, you know, and it's one that a lot of teams have done, you know, whether it's more recently, you think about John Daniels, longtime Rangers chief of baseball ops, goes to the Rays. He's helping them now. The Jays have done it themselves with Ben Charrington here in Toronto. And we've seen Alex Anthopoulos take time in Los Angeles, not with the GM title, but still working in that organization. So it's really interesting, especially because, you know, I've been asking around about this in the last, you know, few days since we learned that James Click was coming to Toronto, and trying to get a sense for what these roles look like. And one theme that was reinforced to me in talking to people around the game about this is really just how different these roles can be from one organization to the next, because not everyone has the same ambitions. Not everyone is in a rush to get back to the GM's office as soon as possible. Doesn't seem like James Click is just, you know, trying to become a GM as quickly as possible. And each person brings their own different strengths. I mean, Brian Sabian, former GM of the Giants, goes to the Yankees, 66 years old. I mean, probably not having the same hands-on approach that he once did. I think that's safe to say. And Click, you know, he's not here to be a substitute to Ross Atkins. He's here to, as you said, oversee things and inspect and kind of learn what people need, learn what are the opportunities for the Blue Jays, what are the ways that they could actually improve the ways that they operate. And so, yeah, just, you know, the more I talked about it and thought about it, it's just a low downside move.
Speaking generally, if you had the opportunity to go join a baseball ops department as an assistant GM, as a vice president, whatever, and you had the leverage when you joined that club to earn a fairly, you know, decent pay grade because of the leverage that you had and because of the experience that you had, and you got to just have a very high title on the front office page and dabble in a bunch of different departments, see what interests you, do different things, get back to your roots, some of the stuff that got you in the game in the first place, and not have to go out in front of scrums of reporters and not have to take the heat when things go wrong and not have to have people like Ben and I saying, why did you do this? Like, why did you do that? That sounds kind of nice, right? Yeah. It sounds like kind of, you know, you're involved in everything. You're on trade calls. You're making decisions on free agents and on extensions. You're evaluating players. You're looking at amateurs. Like, you're doing all that stuff without having to face, you know, the heat, basically, for when any of that stuff goes wrong. Speaking generally, because I haven't talked to James Click, I don't know his motivation.
And hopefully we will get the chance to hear from him. That has not happened yet. But, you know, again, speaking generally, you know, in talking to assistant GMs, there's some people who say that being an assistant GM is just the best job in baseball for some of the reasons that you said. You know, you still have some security and the ability to make an impact in an organization. And yet, you know, there are administrative tasks that go with, you know, if you're a GM, you have a lot of direct reports. You know, that means you have a lot of year-end meetings and, you know, performance reviews. Those are the hiring things, like job interview hiring sessions that you have to be in on. It's a manager, it's in the title, like it's an administrative job in some ways. And the other side of that is you get to make these decisions. There is a thrill to it. And I guarantee that, you know, for some of these executives, it's a thrill to be a general manager. It's a thrill to be out there and have your reputation on the line and have to, there's a bit of a high to that, I imagine.
You're also a public spokesperson, which isn't always the most fun thing to do. At least it doesn't look like, I've never been one, but it doesn't look like one to me. And if you had the opportunity to do one of those assistant GM jobs remotely from your home, where your family is, and not have to like go move to another city and be coming into the office every morning at 6 a.m., maybe still get a little travel sprinkled in there, right? You get to go on the New York Boston trip or whatever, see some cool ballparks and go on the road for a week, come back home. You go up to whatever city, you know, your organization is based in for the trade deadline and, you know, big draft meetings and that. You get to do the sexy, cool stuff, and then you get to go back home and be with your family. Yeah, that sounds okay.
Yeah, note to any GMs looking for further special assistance, Arden is up for the James Click-esque role.
I have just none of the ability and none of the knowledge or know-how.
You know, I think that really...
I would be the Kramer in the front office, just crackers in my briefcase. Sorry, go ahead.
There is something to be said, though, that for a certain personality type, it actually would be more appealing to do that. And again, I'm not speaking about James Click here. I honestly don't know. But I think for a certain personality type, having the ability to make that impact and focus on baseball and only baseball would be appealing. And then for others, you know, the weight of talking to the media and having those obligations would be appealing. Obviously, it's a coveted job for a reason. And part of that is the, you know, everything that comes with it is, you know, both the good things and the more challenging things go with those positions.
Especially when you've been in the number one role and you've seen what it is like. So you've experienced it and you've seen what the grass is like on the other side of the fence.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly seen it, and it got very green in Houston. I mean, to win a World Series really doesn't get better than that.
And what he did in Tampa Bay too is like, while they, you know, they don't have World Series banners like Houston does, I mean, is you talk to anybody in this game and they are like through the moon impressed with what Tampa Bay has been able to do on their budget.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for the Jays, big market team, you can afford an executive like James Click. Like, I don't see the Pirates necessarily going out there and getting him. It does take a certain amount of buy-in to add an executive of his caliber, and just seems like a good thing if you're trying to win baseball games.
You also get to mine his brain and his knowledge and what he learned in those organizations, what worked for them, right? He can now apply some of that stuff in Toronto. Like, he can help you win. So as a GM, Ross Atkins, making this decision and making this hire, you're like, this is a guy who's gonna help us win. If we win, we're sweet. As a GM, just win. Nobody calls for the GM's head when you're winning, right? So adding like somebody like that to your front office is a no-brainer.
Yeah, it really is. And so should be really interesting to hear more about James Click and how he fits in, even if the impact might take a while to reveal itself. Arden, before we get kicked out here, anything else that we should touch on ATL?
Man, I think that's it. I've got a bunch more in the notebook, but maybe I'll save some for later in spring. Anything on your end?
That's it. That is it. So we'll call it a wrap here for the March 2nd episode of At the Letters here from Dunedin, Florida. Thank you to our producers, Gaetan Harris and Nick Andrade, for all of their work putting this together. Thanks to Arden Zwelling, and thanks to everyone for listening to At the Letters.